God, please help me set aside everything I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. For an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. Tonight, I would like to introduce, from Lands Unknown, Fighting Dangerous Beasts Daily, Big Book Tim.
Thank you, Chris. Good evening, everyone. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name's Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Roland, excellent. To reiterate what I said last week, these talks that I'm giving are my experience, my strength, my hope, my knowledge, my research, mostly my opinion on the Big Book and my experience with that. I do try to present facts as I've learned them, as other people have taught them, as they've stuck in my head. As I've said before, I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, although there will be times when I sound like I do. And you know, that's just who I am. And so far, my higher power hasn't seemed fit to remove that defect of character from me yet. So this week we're going to be covering the doctor's opinion and perhaps a little bit of Bill's story. And the books in front of me, I have a replica of the first edition and the fourth edition. And I always work out of my original one that I got at my second meeting, which is the third edition. And because that's the one that's all beaten up and, you know, used, which is what I feel that big books should be. They should be used. They shouldn't be coasters or set upon a shelf or to that nature. But in the first edition, the doctor's opinion was page one. It originally started on page one, and they moved it to the Roman numerals later on. I think more perhaps as because Dr. Silkworth was not a recovered alcoholic, although he was a doctor who worked long and hard with alcoholics. And I'm certainly grateful that he did, because once again, you know, without his expertise and his passion and his desire to work with alcoholics in the nature of an illness and what's been referred to as a disease, you know, I certainly wouldn't be sitting here sober today. That's my opinion about it, because this book wouldn't have happened. And you know, my experience with my recovery and my sobriety has been through this book. I mean, you know, that's why I'm here. You know, I'm also very grateful to this group for asking me to come and share that with you. So to get started, for those of you following along at home, my Roman numeral is XXIII. That's the third edition. And in the fourth, it's XXV. So, and what I do, this is basically how you would experience going through this process if you were sitting across the kitchen table with me. And I'm certainly of the opinion, once again, this is definitely my opinion, that if you're working with a sponsor and there isn't a big book between you, you need to get a different sponsor. That's my opinion. So, okay. Without further controversy for the moment. The doctor's opinion. Thank you. Feel free. Look at that. See, God knocked the book over. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. To me, right there, that kind of like starts the debate right there. You know, because many times people come into AA and they're really not interested in the medical estimate. They're just, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, and that's it, and move on. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. So once again, as we talked about last week in the prefaces and the foreword, you know, that there's the illness side of it, and then there's the solution for which we can recover, and we can become recovered alcoholics. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. And I actually have a photocopy of that letter that Silkworth wrote, and it's on the stationery head from Charlestown's hospital, the hospital that it once was. Doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. And it says, "To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless." And, you know, that's a key phrase that's used throughout the book. And I'm one of those people that truly believes that that's a necessary state of somebody coming into Alcoholics Anonymous in order for maximum benefit to be turned around. It's very difficult to break through that. you know, if people still have ideas of being able to beat it on their own, you know, that they still have hope. I know when I got here, I didn't have any hope. I was 21 when I got sober. And, you know, my master plan of life brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I was kind of hopeless about even just living life. So, in the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conception to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship among these men and their families. This man and over 100 others have appeared to have recovered. There it is, ED, once again. And I think that, what are we up to, like 5 or 6 at this point? I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance. Because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group, they may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D. That last line there, that you may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves, it is my experience that there have been plenty of people who, without the solution provided in this book, have classified themselves as one of those people that you can rely absolutely upon. You know, and this chapter is going to start to talk about the state and condition in which a suffering alcoholic or somebody who is wants to be done drinking needs to be approached. So, continuing. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we cannot control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. And for me, I hear that so many times in meetings, so often, that the physical part is left out. I couldn't imagine being in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and not talking about the allergy to alcohol and what it does to my body. You know, if I didn't have a problem with the alcohol, you know, because it talks about that, and it'll touch upon it later on, and even within this chapter, that if just everything I do is quote-unquote alcoholic, well, I can't be an alcoholic without alcohol. I mean, it's really that. I didn't come in here, you know, there was a guy that I used to know. He said, I didn't come in here because of my ring around the collar. You know, he came in here because he had a problem with alcohol. And it's so often that we sit in meetings and we hear, you know, people talking about everything but alcohol and their problem with it and the solution that they have for it. You know, and to me, that's kind of the crux of it. You know, and it says that in our belief. So I don't understand. You know, the book talks about that quite often, includes the people who were involved in the writing of the book. And as I mentioned last week, it seems like those people, you know, they're far off people. They're not us in this room. You know, and we read what is AA, and we are AA. We are Alcoholics Anonymous. So what applied to them applies to us as well, you know, it says in our belief. Backing up a little bit, to satisfy, it did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking because we were maladjusted to life. I have papers that Silkworth wrote in 1937. One of them is called Alcoholism as a Manifestation of Allergy, and the follow-up to that is the Reclamation of the Alcoholic. And in these two articles, he specifically talks about, you know, alcoholism, the problems, as it talks about later on in the book, and a lot of the ideas that Bill Wilson got when he was writing this comes from these articles. And I encourage people not to take my word for it, you know, to do what I did and do the research. And if you want to find out where I got that, I have no problem sharing that information because I believe that we should do that. It was freely given to me and freely I should pass it on. But within these articles, he addresses specifically that that alcoholism, the mental process behind picking up the drink to cope, that there's an obsession there, that there's a mental obsession that manifests itself as neurosis. And in our particular cases as alcoholics, our choice that we treat that neurosis with becomes the alcohol. And that's how we continue to treat it until it gets to the point where we develop the allergy. And he talks specifically in there about developing the allergy as well. That not, you know, some people, he says some people are born with it, but a lot of other people work really hard to develop it. I know that was certainly my experience. When I first picked up my drink, you know, I wasn't allergic to it immediately. It was definitely a solution, and I enjoyed it and pursued that. And it wasn't until later on that, you know, that I developed the allergy, that I could no longer safely use alcohol. So, the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion to its soundness may, of course, mean little. Although we like to think it means a whole lot more, don't we? But as ex-problem drinkers, interesting note here, and they changed the vernacular throughout the book. It used to say ex-alcoholics. So they changed that later on to match the once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic philosophy. Frankly, I think the latter should have been changed, but that's me. We can say that this explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane. Now, this is the first time that we actually see, I mean, here we are at the beginning of the book, and altruistic means that we give without any thought of payment or reward in return. And so many times we hear, or at least I do, I hear, it's a selfish program. Well, to me, if it were a selfish program, we'd stop at 11. It would be an 11-step program, not a 12-step one. So, you know, we work out the spiritual and as well as the altruistic plane. And then here's a really important thing that we always hear opposite of a lot in meetings. We favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. And how often do we hear people say, if someone's drunk, take him to an AA meeting. Okay, well, if we're going to take him to an AA meeting, there better be somebody who could help with the possibility of the detoxification process. I know, you know, there's very, very seldomly that there are some people in AA meetings who, if somebody goes into DTs, can really be on board and get a hold of that. You know, we hear that all the time, and it just and here it is in our book, saying we favor hospitalization. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he is then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. And once again, I'm reminded of pictures of visions of groups of well-intentioned AAs after meetings talking to the wet drunk who's maybe swaying or half-eyed open and talking about what their problem is, and we're talking to them about how to get sober and what you need, and this is how you do it. And yeah, I know we get back in return, and oh, but it's different, and they're still drunk. You know, in my opinion, that's like trying to teach a pig to sing. I mean, all you're going to do is frustrate yourself and annoy the pig. You know, I'm of the opinion that we should definitely be bringing people to their proper place. I know when I got sober, there was a lot more drying out done at home. You know, people took on that responsibility of carrying wet ones through to the other side. And I know I did it as of 10 years ago. I just can't anymore because I actually work in the profession, so it's a conflict of interest for me, unfortunately. But, you know, hospitalization is really important, and it's important to put out there that medical people should be utilized to their utmost. Because they're trained for that. And despite their philosophy of what alcoholics may be, you know, it's up to us. I can't tell you how many people I've brought to emergency rooms in a state of drunkenness where they were in danger of hurting themselves and other people, and being a part of that person's treatment, you know, annoying the nurse who was looking at this person through pursed lips as though they were just, you know, just somebody who couldn't handle their alcohol and they were just drunk. And how dare they come into my emergency room when I have much more important things to deal with than that. And unfortunately, I mean, here we are. We're almost in the 12th year of the 21st century, and we're still treating it that way. So I find it a personal responsibility to follow that through. I can't just throw a meeting book at somebody and possibly a big book and maybe a cup of coffee and say, "I'll come back tomorrow." You know, just for me, that's just not responsible for me. And then he offers another statement. The doctor writes, "The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction." I always point out paramount is an interesting choice of words, meaning that it's the top of everything. You know, there's other things out there, but this is the top of it. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. Bless you. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. Now, for me, that's the medical director of an alcohol and drug rehabilitation hospital who worked long and hard, who gave us the conception of what alcoholism is. And he's stating that the subject of alcoholism, the solution to it, is covered in masterly detail in this book. And yet we still have plenty of people who run around here and tell you, you don't need to read that book. Just don't drink and go to meetings. Just keep coming. Get yourself a coffee commitment. No, don't worry about that. Do a step a year. Like all this stuff that goes on out there that just doesn't exist in this book. So, we doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. And it's always really interesting to me that, you know, moral psychology talks about that in his papers. And, you know, the powers of good that lie outside of our synthetic knowledge. And synthetic knowledge meaning our book learning, things that we can teach ourselves as human beings. And he's obviously making a reference to the higher power. And trust me when I tell you, the papers that he actually wrote for the medical community are strewn with references, religious references, and God references. So he really put himself out there. I mean, for our sake, it's kind of toned down because, I guess, of the nature of what alcoholics are. We don't really want to. I know I don't want to be told anything. Oh, what do you know? You know? And, yeah, what does he know? Really, you know? So it's interesting that he's talking about, even in 1938, when he wrote this, you know, ultra-modern standards in scientific inquiry. In 1938, ultra-modern scientific inquiry. I mean, we have, like, satellites that could read our wristwatch now, you know. But back then, he was still thinking on that level. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Of course, he's talking about Bill. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and this is interesting, and with some misgiving, we consented. You know, and I always find that very interesting because, you know, it's tough. I'm very fortunate that when I quit drinking, I found the solution. I've yet to have any relapses in my life. But the history behind Bill, I mean, he struggled for almost 15 years before he got sober. You know, and we'll read that later on in his story. So I can understand, like, here's this doctor that has been dealing with this guy for years. And, you want to tell your story to these drunks now? I don't know if that's a good idea. All right, well, you know, and keeping a sharp, close eye on him, you know, so that's interesting that it's there. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. And those cases are in these papers. He writes them in here. And here we are. Look at this. It says it again. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. Now, this is to me, I love this statement here. They believe in themselves and still more in the power, with a capital P, which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Now, through my education, I've been told that anytime some reference to an obscurity or an abstract with a capital means some sort of god or deity. So there he is using that capital P again. But for me, what's really important here is that they say they believe in themselves. And how often, just from introducing myself as a recovered alcoholic within the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the bristling and the looks and the mumbles that happen is truly amazing to me. I mean, I believe in myself, you know, because I have a higher power in my life that is all powerful and runs everything. And when things aren't going right, it's because I'm screwing them up, you know. So it's cool that here's this medical man recognizing the transformation of sick people into healthy people and realizing that they believe in themselves, and then even more so, why they believe in themselves. You know, that's pretty cool to me. And here we go again. It's going to be mentioned again. And this is the doctor saying it now. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor. And this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. You know, and that's the doctor saying it. You know, and for me, it becomes... One of the expressions that I've heard for years that just drives me crazy is, if your ass falls off, pick it up and take it to a meeting. You know? Like, to me, well, there better be somebody in the meeting that puts asses back on, or else you're going to the wrong place. You know, and I feel the same way about if somebody is drunk and they're coming to a meeting, that I know for me, I've often experienced, like, somebody showing up, and I take them outside. I'll get them a cup of coffee, and we'll go outside, and we'll try to talk about, well, where do you want to go? Do you want? We could try to get you into detox. Unfortunately, there's only like four left in the state that have public funding. Or we could take you to an emergency room. We need to do something for you. There's nothing in there that's going to help you. You know, and that's really important. I mean, this is the doctor saying, and it often requires a definite hospital procedure. I mean, through my education, I've learned that there's only one other addiction that comes close to the possibility of death during withdrawal than alcohol. I mean, alcohol is one of the only things that you can actually die from withdrawing from not having it if you need it. You know, so, you know, once again, well-intentioned AAs saying, hey, come on in and sit down, and, you know, somebody can have a seizure right in the meeting. Somebody could have a stroke right in the meeting. I mean, I remember witnessing guys shaking, and this is, you know, when I first got sober, because I didn't know anything about that. Because I thought, wow, that guy must be cold. Because there he was sitting there just shaking in a meeting, and nothing was being done about it. And, you know, and there was scoffing going on, if you can imagine that. Could you imagine scoffing in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at a drunk? I mean, that's just amazing to me. Oh, there he is, drunk again. How dare he? In an AA meeting. Unbelievable. So it's important to me, and I'll continue to say that kind of stuff all the time. And it's important because he prefaces it because he says before psychological measures can have maximum benefit. And that's the whole point of this. The whole point is like, okay, well, if we're going to preach our philosophy, our manner of living, our life that we're supposed to live, they need to be able to hear it. And a drunk doesn't hear anything, except maybe last call, you know? And even then, I know I didn't hear it. I used to argue all the time. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. But he expands upon that in his papers, and I say that because they're just a lot of the stuff that we deal with in the book. You know, Bill kind of distilled it and put it in here for this, and it's taken from his writings. And throughout the years, there have been articles that have proven the physical craving that exists. You know, it talks about the process of alcohol going through anybody. You know, that the alcohol is injected into the system, and it's then processed into acetaldehyde, and through that it's broken down a little further into an enzyme, and then there's an acetate, which is what's known as tetrahydroisoquinoline. I'll spell that for you later. Commonly known as THIQ, and it's common to chronic alcoholics who have the phenomenon of craving. And he tells, and he talks about that right there, and he says the key to that, it's limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. You know, and how often have I heard people like talk about, you know, the functioning alcoholics, the people who, you know, they drink every night after work and they still go home, they still go to work and they get up the next day. And to me, well, obviously they're not one of those chronic alcoholics who has a phenomenon of craving, because they can stop. I know for me, it didn't matter like how often I drank. It didn't matter. It was when I put the alcohol in my system, all bets were off. I didn't know where it was stopping. You didn't know who you were getting that night, you know. It could have been good time Tim, or it could have been, you know, the demon that showed up. And that was, so when I read this, when I that made sense to me. Okay, and now here's a big one. This is pretty controversial right here that he says. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Now, when I got sober, it was 1992 when I got sober, so there was this big, I don't want to say movement, but there was definitely a faction, if you will, that was in AA that were under what they called then the marijuana maintenance program. You know, they were sober, they weren't drinking alcohol, but yet they were managing their illness by smoking marijuana. Right. Nowadays, it seems to be that like solid alcohol is the choice. And when I say that, you know, there are in pill form. There's the opiates and the benzodiazepines. The benzodiazepines specifically work the exact way that alcohol does on the body, exactly the same way chemically, which is why the detoxification process, they use Librium to detoxify from alcohol. And the reason for that is that all medication that we put, even including aspirin, is all metabolized through the liver. But for some reason, Librium is processed and metabolized through the kidneys. So it enables the liver to start to heal itself while staving off the effects of alcohol on the body by replacing it with the other chemicals that are within the Librium. So we have all these other things that are out there, you know, for anxiety that my doctor prescribed. You know, all these things that go on there. Now, for me, this was written in 1938, and it's pretty clear it says in any form at all. And form, in its basic sense, is gas, liquid, or solid. So, you know, and it may have been truer prior to 1976, because that may have been ignored a little better. But in 1976, when the story Dr. Alcoholic Addict was added to the book, and now called Acceptance is the Answer, you know, that completely changed the face of AA, because it specifically talks about pill use in there. You know, it says that I can't say, "Thy will be done," and take a pill. It doesn't say, "I'll let God manage my life, but until He does, I'll take a pill." You know, but we're, you know, it becomes this thing of like, well, you're not a doctor. Okay, well, maybe I'm not. But I'm certainly an educated, recovered alcoholic, and specifically in pharmacology. And I could tell you what's going on with the chemicals that you're taking. And I'll suggest to people, if I know that they're on, I say, you might want to talk to your doctor about that thing that you're on that's causing you to drool on yourself in meetings. You know, and because it's... I just heard this statistic recently, and it blew my mind. 80% of the world's psychotropic medications are manufactured in New Jersey.
Wow.
80% in New Jersey, of the world.
New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York.
New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York. So, right over here. So it's a wonder, you know, that, you know, that may be an outside issue, but, you know, there's a lot of it going on in AA, so it seems to be an inside issue, really. So it's important to notice that, you know. And then he goes on to say, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. You know, that's definitely a description of what my life was. You know, it was like, I can't do anything. Yes.
I don't mean to interrupt the meeting. It's a great meeting. You said all pharmaceuticals?
Psychotropics.
Okay, yeah, what is psychotropics?
Psychotropics are for, like antidepressants, anti-anxiety medication, mood stabilizers.
So are there any anti-anxiety medications that are, if your doctor knows you're an alcoholic?
Yes, there are. There are, and if you want to...
Those are on psychotropics.
They are, but they don't have the same chemical reactions. So if you want, we can talk about that further after the meeting,
okay,
no problem.
Yeah.
Definitely. Thanks for the question. I appreciate that. my life was definitely like that. You know, everything was astonishingly difficult. How am I going to go to school? How am I going to take a shower? I mean, you know, because I've mentioned this before, you know, people, places, and things, changing people, places, and things was a dumb suggestion to me because I drank in the shower. I wasn't going to stop showering. And most people appreciated that, you know. So it was a source of anxiety for me. How am I going to take a shower without a beer? How am I going to shave without a beer? How am I going to get dressed without a beer? I needed answers to those. Those were like, they seem like basic stuff now, but to an alcoholic who's, I don't know how to deal with life. You know, that's astonishingly difficult to solve, right? Now, I love this. To me, this is a very descriptive sentence here. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. My, how often do we see that in AA? Frothy, what a wonderful, I lived in LA for a year, so that was really, there was coffee all over, everybody was having lattes, you know. And so that frothiness, that just empty foam and air and emotional appeal seldom suffice, and just the, oh, what's the matter with you? You gotta get over, you know. And it's amazing, it's one of the only illnesses that people actually get yelled at for. You know what I mean? Nobody says, why do you have lupus? You know? It's amazing. And it seldom suffices, and with good reason. Because I know, when I was drinking, don't yell at me. I'll have another beer. You know what I mean? I'll drink at you. I'll toast you and drink. You know what I mean? So then it goes on to say the importance of it, the message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. So to me, that's depth and weight. And that's what anybody who's here and engaging in this tonight, that's what we're doing. We're creating depth and weight in our messages. You know, because I know, for me, I remember this specifically. I remember when I got sober, I didn't want to go to AA because you were just a cult that wanted to hold hands and say prayers. And so I wanted, I was special. I was a unique alcoholic. So just, counseling would do for me. So I started calling counselors, and I would ask them, are you an alcoholic? And they'd say, no. I said, well, then what the hell do you know? I mean, because I was ignorant at the time, but nevertheless, I mean, that's what we're going to get. That's a natural thing. It's a natural thing. I know, for me, I always talk about this. I never understood, maybe a little racy, and I apologize for that. I never understood how men could be gynecologists. I just never understood that. You know, they're not working with the same equipment. They really can't identify. Like getting head shakes over there. But to me, so it makes sense to me, that statement, the message that can interest and hold an alcoholic needs to have depth and weight. And, so it's a... Anybody... There was a guy that I knew, he's not with us anymore, but he used to say that he would drink 3 glasses of wine a night. Every night, 3 glasses of wine. It was never one... It was never 2, it was never 4. It was 3 glasses of wine a night. I couldn't identify with this guy. There's no way that message had depth and weight to me. I was like, what are you kidding me? What's it? But the reason that he considered himself an alcoholic is because he could not have those 3 glasses of wine every night. He couldn't function without that. He would obsess about those 3 glasses of wine. And so it compelled him to do that, which is what Silkworth talked about. But I could identify with other people who would get kicked out of their homes and who had people mad at them all the time, who lost their jobs, Who woke up going, where am I? Who woke up going, who are you? Who woke up going, where's my wallet? Who woke up, like, you know, with their face throbbing from getting hit? You know, I mean, I could certainly identify with that. That had breadth and weight to me, you know, and so that was important. And then, that talks about the ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. And I know I was trying to recreate my life constantly, and it never worked, because it wasn't a power greater than me. It was me trying to recreate. It just didn't work, right? And then he says, if any feel that as psychiatrists directing a hospital for alcoholics we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments, and the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel, after many years of experience, that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Well, there's that word again, that non-selfish program growing up among them. And to me, like, I identify with that statement. It's a part of my daily work. I see those tragedies all the time. Tragedies. I hear about them. I see them. And I don't know about anybody else who does work with alcoholics or not, but it does definitely become a part of my sleeping moments. You know, waking up going, oh my God, I got to think about that. I got to call them. And, you know, other people's issues and problems become mine, whether I want them to or not. You know, and to me, that's truly a blessing. That if I'm the last person I'm thinking about, I'm in a good place. Because if I'm the one I'm thinking about, I'm definitely thinking about the wrong person. Definitely. For me, that's me. I don't know where anybody else is at. Now, here's the part I absolutely love. I quote this often. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Now, it doesn't say alcoholics. It's just men and women. Okay? For everyone. And now he turns to the alcoholic. He says, the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but when I got here, I lied about everything. Everything. How tall I was, how much I weighed. You know, how much I drank. I don't know, did anybody else lie about that? I couldn't differentiate the true from the false. You know, everything was happening to me. You know what I mean? That was how I perceived the world. Everything, you would drink if you had my parents, and you would drink if you had my job, and you would drink if you didn't have the job I had, and you would drink if she didn't like you, or if she did like you. That was who I was, you know, so it's really cool when you're on the other side of it and you watch that whirlwind come through the door and you kind of sit there and smile and go, oh, thank God. But I can help you. No, you don't, you know. And that's always really cool. I don't know if anybody else ever experienced this. But when somebody says to me, I can't imagine you having a drinking problem. Wow. I mean, I'm like, you want some numbers? You know what I mean? Like, and it becomes that. To me, those kind of statements are really the crux of the transformation of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I remember, I mean, I haven't had a drink in almost 19 and a half years. But I can still remember what kind of a-hole I was like. I definitely remember, you know, because I'm still in the process. I'm always in that process. There's still people I need to find to make amends to from 20 years ago. Because it's there. So whenever God provides it, you know. So moving on. And then this is definitely one of my favorites. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience that sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Now, I love that description. That description to me is the epitome of why I drank. It's why I drank. When I was feeling restless. Like, oh my God, I can't sit here. I gotta go someplace. This is awful. You know? And irritable. Anybody else irritable? I hate everybody and talking through my teeth. And, you know, the effects of the alcohol are wearing off and I need some more and I can't wait. I'm gonna punch my boss in the face. I can't wait to get out of here. Right? You know, discontent. Like, I'm gonna kill my boss. You know? I hate this. I hate me. I hate the world. I hate life. I hate, when am I gonna die? You know, all that stuff. And then I would take that drink, and that light switch would go off, and I would get that sense of ease and comfort, that, ooh, ah, yeah. Because that's what I got from it. That's what I got. And I would see other people doing that, because that's why men and women drink. They drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. So did I. But they could do it and not get in trouble and not get punched in the face and know where they're going and know where their car keys are and wake up at home and still have their job the next day and not get in trouble with somebody else and still have their wife or their girlfriend or husband, whatever you have, the next day. You know, like, I didn't understand that. What? How do you do that? How do you do that? I drink and all this stuff happens. So, and they say, well, maybe it's your drinking. I say, no, it's not that. How do you do that, you know? And then he goes on. He says, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. You know, he starts to talk there about the physical, the obsession of the mind, the compulsion of the body, and the insanity of that. That we just go around in a circle. I mean, it's very inert. You know, it's like once you set it in motion, it's going to keep going in that circle. And until a wedge is placed in it, it's just going to keep going and going and going. Like that crazy commercial that used to be on television, you know. I do more drugs so I can work harder, so I can make more money, so I can do drugs. You know, just round and around it goes. And then he talks about the solution. He tells us what the solution is. An entire psychic change. Psychic meaning how I think and how I look at the world. An entire, not just little, not just a piece of it, not just mostly, not just some of it, not, well, you know, I'm getting better. Entire. So my whole attitude and outlook has to change. My belief system, my core values, my belief has to change. I can't, be angry at the world. All these things. Like, whatever it is that I'm thinking currently while I'm in that situation is wrong. And I don't know about anybody else when I got here and I heard the notion that everything I thought was wrong. What? How can I be wrong about everything? And they say, well, you're in AA, aren't you? And I say, yeah, but aren't I right about that? You know, like, you know, those arguments, you know. Right? So then it says, on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, unfortunately a lot of those people are in AA, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. 12 of them, to be exact. 12 rules to follow for that. And that's, I mean, to me, that's amazing. Once an entire psychic change has occurred. So this doctor is telling us that, yes, you need to have that entire psychic change, and it's possible. You can do it. You could, and then you can, what's that say? You can easily control your desire for alcohol? What? That's not possible for an alcoholic. It most certainly is. That's how we become recovered. And then he says the only effort necessary that required is following a few simple rules. Well, what are they? Get a sponsor, get a home group, go and commit. No. A few simple rules. 12 steps. Follow steps. Don't drink, go to meet. No. Do some steps. Trust God, clean house, help others. That's amazing to me, right? And then he says, men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. Oh, there's my colon. Remember my colon from last week? A-hole, right? Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Essential. Not like, well, you know, possible, you know, kind of important. Essential. You know, it's a synonym of vital. Necessary for life. Right? Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. And he goes on to in great detail in his papers about that. But it is important that to note that the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable. And so often I hear in AA,
AA is the only way to fix an alcoholic.
No, it's not. It definitely isn't. It definitely works for me. It's worked for millions of other people. However, it's not the only way. And other ways do work. So I'm not going to, like, dismiss good doctors and good psychiatrists and good therapists and good counselors and good priests or rabbis or anybody else that is doing the same thing that we're doing because they're not doing it the way we're doing it. That's just, to me, that's just, handicapping myself. You know, and it's really cool, his humility there, by when he states, if he's honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Now, here's the doctor, you know, like, he was the best. He was the best of his time. And he admitted that, oh, well, you know, I'm inadequate. And unfortunately, and that's why I get crazy about that, are you a doctor stuff, you know, because doctor isn't spelled G-O-D. It's doctor. It's not God. And quite often, doctors don't admit their own inadequacies. Oh, well, you must not be taking the medication the way you're supposed to be. You must not, you. Instead of going, well, I don't know. Maybe we can try something together. You know, and I don't know about anybody else, when I'm in any sort of treatment for anything in my life, I'm the spearhead of my own treatment. I run my treatment. They're supposed to give me information and a well-informed self-conscious, group conscience. You know what I mean? Like, they're there to work for me. I can't know everything, but they're supposed to be experts. So if I'm telling them something and they're giving me crap in return, I'm going to get annoyed. Like, you're telling me I should take this. I just told you I'm a recovered alcoholic and a recovered addict, and you're telling me that I need to take this medication that has the same elements? What are you, stupid?
Well, it's what's indicated.
You know, so like, you know, to me, it becomes one of those things of like, definitely need to be careful. You know, we need to be careful about those kinds of things. There are doctors who specialize in addiction. They belong to a specific group of doctors who have certifications that understand addiction. And if they're not one of them, you know, that we may be getting advice from, we may be getting the wrong advice. You know, I'm certainly not going to go to an oncologist if I have a broken leg. It's not going to happen. Oh, it must be cancer. We got to get rid of that leg. No, can we just reset it? Oh. Well, you know, I'm the doctor. You know, it's that mentality. So, sorry about the soapbox, but that's that, you know. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink or so prior to the date, and the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. Okay, so it talked about, you know, that's specific to the obsession of how am I going to deal with this? And then they take that drink and it sets off that phenomenon of craving and they just can't stop it. The drinking becomes paramount to whatever it was that they were doing and the alcoholic life becomes the only one they know. Right? There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than to fight. Now he's going to go on to try to classify some alcoholics and it's important. This is important, and I identify with all of this. I don't know about anybody else. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. There is the type of man who is unwilling to admit he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood about his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. And yet we didn't write the chapter. There are the types entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. Okay, now that's, to me, that's really important because I'm not one of those people who does everything alcoholically. Okay, I don't shop alcoholically. I can buy a lottery ticket and not need another one. There's lots of things that other people who have a different obsessive compulsive mind than I do can do. You know, so he's talking about people who have this issue with alcohol, and that's it. And once that's taken care of, they can run their lives the right way, and that doesn't transfer over to some new obsession. Okay, so that's important, because there's a lot of those, you know. There's, I mean, some people, yeah, to a great extent, have that. But, you know, here it is. Now, he says, all of these and many others have one symptom in common. And there's my colon again, right? They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. Period. That's what they have in common. You know, so those people who come in here and who are not hopeless alcoholics, who can go on sprees, but maybe have two drinks and then stop. Oh, it was bad because I had two drinks. You know, those types of... I don't know. I don't know what's going on there, because there's no phenomenon of craving. And this doctor is telling us that there's a phenomenon of craving. Now, here's the thing I'd like to talk about, the phenomenon of craving. Because people try to get around that, too. True alcoholics who can go intervals without drinking. And don't... You know, they'll drink maybe that two, three drinks and it's a non-event. You know, nothing happens, so maybe I'm making a big deal out of this. Their obsessive thinking about the next time they can do that kicks in. Because I've talked to them about it. Because they try to deny it. I've talked to a lot of people. Oh, you know, last time I drank, I had three drinks, and that was fine. I said, okay, well, where were you? Oh, I was at the bar. What'd you do after that? I went home. I said, so you just had three drinks, and you got into the car and drove? Yeah. Well, you were drunk. No, it was fine. No, well, you were legally drunk. Well, you know, and then it goes back to what he talked about earlier. That the only, like, their alcoholic life is the only normal one. They cannot differentiate the true from the false. Okay, so that obsessive thinking is still there. It hasn't been changed just because there was a long period of abstinence. The entire psychic change didn't happen. It didn't occur. So that's kind of, it's important to point that out. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart from as a distinct entity. It has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Now, there was another movement that I experienced, maybe 15 years ago. There was a drug out there called Fen-Phen that people were taking to, so they can drink normally. So alcoholics can drink normally. That always amazes me. Like, well, I'm going to take a pill so I can drink normally. I never wanted to drink normally. You know, it talks about that later on in the book. You know, controlling and enjoying your drinking. If you're controlling it, you're not enjoying it. If you're enjoying it, you're not controlling it. That's my experience, right? Entire abstinence. And then he said that he knows what's coming. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written, pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I could best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He lost everything worthwhile in life and was living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted that he believed that for him, there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partially recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. Now, I don't know if anybody else has ever experienced that within recovery. Like, I have, like, having met somebody who got sober, and then I hadn't seen them in years, and they come back, and they'd say, hey, I remember you, you're Big Book Tim, and you said this, and I'm looking at them going, who the hell are you? Because they're... their face has changed, they look better, they're dressing better, they're obviously talking better, they're smelling better, you know, everything's, you know, oh, I think I remember you, and then, oh, yeah, wow, and then they go away, and you're like, wow, that's pretty amazing. It's amazing what this stuff does, right? And then he goes on, when I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and deciding the situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. That was Fifth M, was the person of that guy's name. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated that he thought treatment was a waste of effort, unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology. And we doubted even if that would have any effect. Now, what he's talking about in moral psychology, that's also in his papers, the difference is that there's normal psychology, which has nothing to do with God, and then there's moral psychology, which has everything to do with God. And God in the sense that we talk about in AA, a personal God that is no specific deity, that it's just beyond human. And he believes in that. Okay. And last thing he said, however, he did become, quote-unquote, sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is the finest specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through. And though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. William D. Silkworth, M.D. Now there he is. He's giving an opinion. He's telling people, any alcoholic, earnestly, to read this book. He's not saying, I advise and earnestly advise any alcoholic to go to a meeting. He said, read this book. And even in his papers, he breaks down the process of recovery and at that time talked about that it wasn't necessary, but it was favorable to go to weekly meetings. Because that's what existed then. Weekly meetings. So, you know, he's every year... At least one of our AAs, Barefoot Bill, who spoke here with Lena, they have a memorial service to Silkworth, who is buried in New Jersey. He's buried down in was it Lakehurst or down Monmouth County down there. And it's you can often it's usually announced, and there's a place to find out about that stuff. But to me, you know, I mean that chapter is only 9 pages. 9 pages, and to me it's one of the most poignant chapters in the book because it sets up who we are. It sets up that we are obsessive compulsive people, that's the problem. Now, unfortunately, this may create a little controversy. I'm not, you know, I don't champion the disease model, okay? Based on what we just read, I champion an obsessive compulsive disorder, which is a mood disorder, and we have a physical aspect to that mood disorder. We have an allergy. So, you know, people can be obsessive-compulsive about wanting to eat peanuts, and they could be obsessive-compulsive about wanting to eat strawberries. And if they have any, they'll have an allergic anaphylactic reaction to it. And as long as they don't have that, they're not going to die from it. Okay, so as long as I don't put alcohol in my body, I'm not going to die from it. So that's where I get into the splitting hairs. However, the obsessive-compulsive nature of my mood disorder, and he talks about that, Bill talks about that later on in the book, and he says that we're modern miracles of mental health, you know, and there's no such thing as alcoholism. There's alcohol abuse and alcohol dependence in the medical field. I know that's outside issues, but I'm here to pass on knowledge. And once anyone has achieved a year of abstinence and symptom-free from alcohol dependence, they are known as being in full remission. So according to the world that says we have a disease, once we are no longer in the disease part of it for a year, according to them, we are cured. I don't believe that we're cured. I certainly believe that we can become recovered, that we can arrest it one day at a time, provided that we follow the few simple rules and continue to do that on a daily basis. You know, I don't know about anybody else, but there's a lot of times that I don't want to do 12-step work. because I'd rather just, you know, I don't feel like it. Something, you know, like I want to lie in bed, or so it's important to for me to do this kind of stuff, and I hope I didn't ruffle too many feathers while doing it, and I hope I helped somebody today. So thank you. Anybody have questions?
We have questions, critiques, comments,
arguments,
queries, arguments,
quibbles,
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 feathers that need to be unruffled.
I just wanted to touch on that obsession piece that you were talking about. Because I've talked to her about sometimes women are women that, you know, we're obsessive compulsive people.
Yeah.
And that we have to be careful with the gambling, we have to be careful with, you know, this and that and whatnot.
Yeah.
So I really like the way that you broke it down and defined it and how you put it, because it just gives me a little more clarity. Because I'm looking around like, oh, like maybe if I buy a body, maybe I
right.
You know, and there's the guilt that goes with it.
Sure.
There's a guilt that stays there. I'm like,
right.
Maybe I shouldn't buy that lottery ticket, or maybe I should, you know, do this or that. But, you know.
Well, ultimately, Alcoholics Anonymous, the process of the steps, is replacement therapy is what it is. So when we're obsessive compulsive, when we're in the illness, we're obsessing about drinking or any other thing that's going on, gambling, whatever it is. So when we come in and we decide that we make a decision to go through this process in order to become recovered, we're replacing whatever obsession it is with our higher power. So now when things come up, when we're triggered by anything that normally sent us to a drink or to a lottery ticket or something else, now we obsess about God, and that compels us to pray, and compels us to meditate, and it compels us to go help other people. So we're replacing that obsession with one that's productive, hopefully, and that that will solve all our problems. So that's kind of like the crux of what we do. It's really cool. Yeah.
I'm Frank. I'm an alcoholic.
Frank.
Thanks very much for speaking to
sure.
me. I got a lot out of it, a lot of identification. But I had 16 years, and I wasn't recovered yet. I was going to meetings, and I was talking to people, and I thought I got this. Yeah. Everywhere I go, I see people, and here's the thing, I wasn't recovered, man. I got 2.5 years back, but you know, when I think I got it, I'm in trouble. That's for me. That's what I'm sure.
I just wanted to comment on something you said. So-called normal drinkers who throughout my life would say to me periodically, don't you ever get enough? You know, and the answer really was, though I didn't know it at the time, was no. Because it's crazy. Whereas they, for the most part, experience enough every time they drink, more than likely. And that's one of the misconceptions that they don't understand.
Yeah.
And when I heard explaining that, it helped a great deal.
I'm Chris, I'm not called. I shared yesterday, and you know, in my story, I'm always like, oh, you know, at some point I crossed the line. And this, I remember last week we were talking, and I knew we were going into the doctor's opinion, and I love this chapter, and I told you, and I was like, you know, and it says, this is what I love the most about Big Book workshops, because, you know, you finally see the. I share, oh, I crossed the line, you know, and, you know, but then the book actually, you know, you see it in the book, you know, that chronic alcohol is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to these class, and it never occurs in the average temperate. The allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form, and once having formed the habit or crossed the line, found they cannot break it.
Yep.
You know, and it's just, you know, the answers, when you see them, I mean, you know, the book was written in 1935 or whatever, and, you know, and it's like, oh, man, you know, I relate so good to this, you know, or so much. It's funny because I made a just real quick, I made like a huge realization this weekend, you know, you know, people who are gifted, like with guitar or piano, you know, they go to Berkeley or they go to Juilliard.
Be nice if they got Juilliard. If you go to Juilliard, you get Juilliard.
That's where they go. You know, and I was fortunate enough to meet one of my guitar heroes, and I, you know, and he's so good. And in one of his interviews, he says that he went to school after he. You know, after he was playing, just to learn what he was already playing, and that's what I feel. You know, like that's his talent. My talent is getting drunk, and like this is my Berkeley, like AA, yeah. Big Book Works. Yeah. It's weird, but it's like, you know, this that's my talent is to get drunk. You know, and now I'm finding out. You know what I went. You know what I'm going through is, and it's like being spelled out in the book. And I thank you. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
All right, well.
We have a moment of silence for the alcoholic in and out of this room suffering. Close with the serenity prayer. God?
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
That is day. Yes.
I would really like my name. Yes. Me too. I would really like to thank. I first came back to Canada. I went to I need some guidance.
Well, I can tell you.
I have